Welcome back to the Whitetail Watch podcast. On today's episode, myself and Eric Barber are going to call Jeff Sturgis of Whitetail Habitat Solutions. And y'all are going to want to take some notes on this one. This guy knows a ton of stuff about hunting whitetail deer. Jeff's from Wisconsin, isn't that right?
Yep, western Wisconsin.
I see. Yeah, and his website, like we said, is Whitetail Habitat Solutions. You can check out lots of articles, tons of information about managing your property for deer. And not only that, but managing your property to hunt deer.
Right, and on a budget. A lot of the things that Jeff does are stuff that the average guy can do with, you know, a good day's work and a few bucks. So it doesn't really take a whole lot to do some of these projects. It's just the know-how to know how to do them.
Right, exactly. And we're going to cover how to create bedding areas, some small tips that you can use everyday guys just to enhance their tree stand locations. Talking about man-made water holes and how important they can be. Also, Jeff knows a bunch about timing your hunts.
Right.
You know, and that's really important for the average Joe who is sort of trying to pick those vacation days.
And maybe, weekend warriors.
Yeah, weekend warriors, those guys that only have a few days to hunt. Maybe you only have a few days to hunt on a small property. Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff's going to give you a bunch of information on how to choose those hunts perfectly and time them right so that you can get in there and hunt your target bucks. But we'll go ahead and give Jeff a call and start talking some deer hunting.
Hello, this is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff, what's going on? This is Aaron Warburton calling.
Hi, Aaron. How's it going?
Good. Myself and Eric are sitting here, and we're looking at the Whitetail Habitat Solutions website, checking out some of your recent articles and stuff.
Oh, yeah. How's it going, Eric?
Good. How are you, Jeff?
Good, good. Not too bad. We were just, we just made it back. We were, we put a water hole out last Friday. We filmed it all and all that kind of stuff, and then we had a camera on it. We had a mock scrape, and just looking at a shooter that came into the water like 3 days later, and beautiful footage. So we were just looking at it on the computer screen. So
cool,
kind of some fun stuff. But
you betcha.
Yeah,
a lot of that stuff going on this time of year.
Oh man, yeah, it's every day it's something.
Right. Well, that's going to actually be our first topic that we're going to touch on. With you.
Okay.
That's one reason why I got Eric up here with me is our viewers have watched him hunt over water holes in southeast Wisconsin, right?
Yep.
And he's had great luck using man-made water holes and used a lot of the tips that he got from you, actually.
Oh, yeah. I got a lot of the stuff that I did with those water holes or stuff that I got off your website. And And it was stuff as simple as, you know, using a kiddie pool on a small, you know, 36-acre piece that I had permission to hunt, and it worked out great.
Yeah, with that being said, Jeff, let's just dive right off into it. I want you to cover just everything water holes, man-made, natural, whatever. You know, what they are, when they work, and why.
Okay. Yeah, the, you know, what I've loved the water holes for is that, They're just a quick stop. And so when you have a water hole and you place that between food in the afternoon and a bedding area, it just becomes a quick stop to where you can put a stand location over it, and especially a bow stand, and you can expect those deer to just come right into the water. They're there for a minute or two, so you're not really exposing yourself too much to them like you would be on a food plot, and then they're gone to food. And so, you know, the water gives you a great advantage to take advantage of that movement and define that movement, help to define that movement. And it can be a, you know, a piece of everything else too, travel corridors, mock scrapes, and, you know, it's in between food and bedding. But really, that's why I like the water. And, you know, the type of water that you put in or the type of container, the type of water hole you put in, you know, I love when we can take a backhoe in and we can create a berm on the downhill side if there's a ridge. We can put a relief pipe in and we can create a water hole that might be 12 by 15 feet, might be 2 to 3 feet deep, and it self-fills. But that's not always the option that you have or that even the landowners have. So, a 70-gallon tank, 100-gallon tank, 150-gallon tank that you can dig into the ground and either let it self-fill or, you know, actually fill it yourself is just can be an outstanding option. And so what I use the water for is really if you have dry bedding, a water hole is appropriate. And what I mean by that is, let's say you have a point going out off the end of an ag field, and on that point, just below it, there might be some benches, which there usually are, and you have a large number of deer bedding there. Well, if they're bedding dry and there's no water between that bedding area and the food source, then it's a perfect place for a water hole. Now, even if there's water down below in the valley, if they have to drop 200 feet in elevation and travel 150 yards, then they're really going the opposite direction of that food source up above, which might be a food plot or, you know, an ag field. And so they're completely out of the picture at that point. And they don't want to have to do that either. If their food source is up on top and they're going to that food source and that's their daily pattern, that gives you the opportunity to put that water hole in that dry location and expect those deer to just pinpoint their activities. What I see, too, in the early season, those deer are really keen on that water in the evening and afternoon, because kind of think about it, they've been sitting dry all day. And I almost think that, you know, they're basically thinking about that water. They can't wait to leave their bedding area, hit that water, and then hit the greens. Now, when they hit the greens, they're feeding on green vegetation all night, and they don't need to hit that water in the morning. So the cool thing is you can count on that for evening, early season. Really, I've even seen them hit it pretty decent in the late season, too. But you know when the rut starts, if you have a camera on that water hole, which we usually do, you put a camera on that water hole, as soon as you start getting buck pictures in the morning, then you know that pre-rut's starting. And a lot of times, like around where I'm at in southwest Wisconsin, that might be October 23rd, October 24th, 25th. But as soon as you get those pictures, you know it's starting to begin. And that's a outstanding time to start switching your tactics. And you're either sitting on a bench or a cruising corridor that relates to that water all day, or you're hunting in the morning, you're hunting in the evening, and so it gives you a great opportunity. And so water, you know, if you have dry bedding, if you can place it between the dry bedding and a food source, then it can just be a money spot. And it can be, hey, we just put a water hole out on the 24th of June, and we just checked it today. And on the 27th, we had a shooter come in. It looks to be at least 4 years old, maybe five.
Oh, cool.
And so he was coming into that water hole and using it. And what I like to do with those tanks, this is a 70-gallon tank, is we actually dug it down into the ground so it's flush with the soil.
That's a great tip. And one other thing that I thought that you mentioned in an article, or I was watching one of your YouTube videos or something, you said their food source will also dictate, you know, when they need water. Like you just mentioned a minute ago, green food source, they may not need it as much, but what about dry food sources like grains or something?
Oh, man, that's a great point. I really believe, like, you'll have properties that are just basically soybeans and corn. And, you know, soybean leaves offer a lot of moisture when it gets into, you know, before September, so August, September. But as soon as those leaves turn brown, then they're really not going to add much at all. And when you get into November, as it gets closer to December, then those grains are offering very, very low moisture content. I think brassica leaf might be 75-80% moisture and digestible, and where when you get into the corn, it might be 14%, 15%, 12%. And so I believe in those cases, if they don't have green available, you can actually lose deer off your property at that time as they're going onto an adjacent property, either to seek greens or to seek water. So it's a really good point. It's great to have water, and it's really important if you just have corn and soybeans. And a lot of people do in the ag rotations that might be around their land.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, a lot of guys that are hunting these, I mean, myself, I have a small place that I have permission to hunt down here in Iowa, and that's the rotation that we're always dealing with is corn and soybeans. So I guess the question I had for you is, how do you go about locating those water holes? You know, if you have basically a farm that's, you know, a 50-50 mix of crop and timber, you know, you don't obviously want to locate it right in the center of your timber. You want to make it in a spot that's easy enough to access and hunt. So how do you go about locating them?
That's a good question, too. I think the what's really important is that, for one, you can put a bow stand over. I never install a water hole if I can't put a bow stand over it, because I have some close friends of mine, I think of, that their water hole is about 80 yards away from their nearest stand. Well, they're getting incredible buck pictures on that water hole, yet, you know, they're almost pulling deer away from that stand location. They have a couple stand locations there, and so it's not really defining the movement by those stands. So what I'm looking for is, you're already looking for an area where the deer are bedding here in point A, and they're moving to point B as a food source, and you're just installing that water hole in between. So I'm looking primarily, I want it to be a bow stand location, and two, I don't want it to be so close to the bedding area that I'm going to spook out the bedding area for an afternoon sit, and I don't want it so close to the morning, that food source that I'm spooking it out in the morning when I go in.
Right.
So I'm looking for, out here in Southwest Wisconsin, we have a lot of hills, and so I'm looking for a bench and maybe a point that's extending out to a bedding area where I know the bedding area is below that location. A lot of times I'm trying to take advantage of almost an X pattern where you have the deer coming from the bedding area, going to the food source. That's one movement. And then you're inside the woods far enough to where you're actually cutting that parallel cruising buck that's cruising the field edge during the middle of the day, let's say 75 yards back. Maybe that bedding area is 125 yards back. And so you're getting in that location where you're 50, 75 yards from bedding area or food. You're connecting the dots from movement from bedding to feeding, and you're also sitting and watching that cruising funnel. And so then, you're establishing that water in that location, but that's, you have one stand location. Now I'm looking at if I have a point or I have alternative access, access point, then a lot of times you can actually set up two stand locations in an area like that where I call them complementary stand locations, where you can use one for one set of winds and one for the other. One, you're coming in from one direction, one the other. And so you can really get a lot of life out of that one water hole. And who knows, it might even set up another stand location that's 150 yards away on that same bench. And so you're actually setting up a third stand.
Yeah, what I like about that you just said is that you're setting up the water hole specifically for hunting. It's like getting a bow stand within fairly close distance, proximity to that water hole. But you're also anticipating two different types of movement there. Rut movement, yes, and then natural feeding movement. So you can hunt that thing during, really any time of the season, which is pretty ingenious.
Definitely.
When you think of it. Yeah. But what other quick tips do you have for like tree stand location like that? Because I've seen you do lots of other things just to optimize a tree stand spot.
Well, one of the things that we've been doing for a long time, but that we just did last week with that new water hole too, is we added a mock scrape in that same location. So it's one more thing to sweeten the pot. Now on that particular property that I'm hunting, we can't cut a lot. And so if I could cut a little bit, even just hinge cut slightly, then I would I would cut some of the trees down to either pinch the deer into that location. And I'd leave a pretty wide gap, a 30, 40-yard gap, so the deer didn't feel like they were coming to this 20-foot-wide hole they had to go through. But I'd pinch them down so that we're setting up the two adjacent bow stands. And I might even add a travel corridor to that where we're actually hinging the trees at waist to belly level away from the deer trail, perpendicular to the deer trail, and just making it so that we're basically collecting these trails over on this side. We're taking two or three trails, necking them down to one and shooting them at the water or the mock scrape, and we're doing that maybe in another direction too, so we can actually define that X pattern even to a greater level. So it might be that we're creating a travel corridor. It might be that we're going out 40 yards from the stand and we're dropping some timber so that the deer either have to go in front of us or way behind that cutting where we wouldn't have been able to get a shot anyways. But then adding the mock scrape. Now another thing too, some people add some minerals if it's legal in a location, and that helps to also connect that. And then of course if you have a food source, food plot on the other side of it, then you're just putting a lot of pieces of the puzzle together right in one spot to make sure that those deer are going to go through exactly where you want them to for a bow shot.
Sure. And you just mentioned on small properties or large properties, this type of tactic can work. And that, like Jeff is mentioning here, a lot of this stuff is fairly simple to do. If you do a little bit of research and put in the legwork, you could do it on any type of a property. What's the main mistakes that you see people making on smaller farms? Let's just say 100 acres or less, just, spitball a figure out there. But that's what a large majority of hunters are dealing with are those smaller properties. What would you say the main mistake they make when it comes time to, manage or hunt those small pieces?
Well, I can almost think of two mistakes. I'll just mention one really quick, and that's they're not choosing the optimum conditions to hunt. For example, they might have a favorite stand and they're burning it out on an 82 degree day on October 29th, just because it's October 29th. When 3 days later it was going to be a high of 57, there's a huge temperature drop, barometric pressure is high in optimum condition. So that's one thing, you're using stands at poor timing. But really, I think one of the big things, and it boils down to, back to even using the stands at a bad time, is that guys are getting into their property too deeply, and they're not protecting those core areas or those sanctuary areas. So everyone says they have a sanctuary, but to me, a sanctuary is actually an area where a deer can't see you, hear you, or smell you. And so, guys will be able to walk along, they'll make a lot of noise next to a sanctuary, but they don't have those core areas that make up 60-70% of their land that allow the deer to get into and feel comfortable. And even on 40 acres, my parcels I hunt are 40 and 45 acres. And so I have about 25 to 30 acres out of both those that I consider the core area for the deer that I just simply stay out of. And so I found that I can chip away on the outside of that with water holes and movements to food sources and hunting the lay of the land. And I can chip away with that with different access points, and I can get a buck that's in that area when he eventually comes out or when he's coming in from a different property. And so I'm maintaining the integrity of the property by, managing that efficiency of about 60-70%. And I think, it only takes one trail going through the middle of the property and two or three hunts and sits, and you've blown out the whole property if it's 30, 40 acres.
Right.
And so that's a big mistake, just over hunting at the wrong times, and then of course how it's accessed. Less is a lot more when it comes to consistently shooting a mature buck and being able to get on that and get out.
Right, I agree. And that kind of goes into our next question. Like you, I'm hunting a lot of small property myself, and the hardest, probably the most difficult thing to decide is when do you push into your best stands? How do you maximize your sits on those smaller pieces where you might only have a handful of good sits? How do you maximize those?
That's one of the things that's kind of an art. It's something really that's important that people need to develop. It takes a lot of patience because everyone wants to go in and hunt their favorite stand. And it's very important for one, almost on any property, guys are hunting when they shouldn't hunt. I've done it. We've all done it. It's hard to resist the temptation to go in there. But if you can be very patient, and there's a couple things. I hunt by the weather. I hunt by cold fronts. And so I'm hunting when the conditions, and if I can see those cold fronts coming up, say, for example, Friday is supposed to be just a miserable day. It's leading into Saturday. Friday was a high of 82. It was in the middle of October. And then Saturday was supposed to be on the way down, huge winds, big thunderstorm. And then I see that Sunday evening, everything's quieting down, it's cool. And I might hunt that Sunday evening and just forget about the rest of the weekend, even if I had those days off of Friday and Saturday to burn. And so that power of that one Sunday evening sit is worth more than that entire Friday and Saturday and maybe even Sunday morning combined. And so I look at each sit as a value, and that's a 10 out of 10 right there on that Sunday evening, even if it was October 17th, where those other ones don't combine to even equal a 10. When you combine them all at the same time, they're destroying that 10 out of 10 set because you're overhunting the property.
Right.
And so I'm looking for those conditions of, when are optimum weather conditions to get in the stand. And even if you go by moon phase, I don't really pay attention to the moon too much other than I do hunt middle of the day or late afternoons when you have a full moon, because I feel like there's a higher value. Deer feed five times in a 24-hour period, and that feeding cycle ends up being enhanced because they were just basically feeding fat and lazy and stupid all night. So that's a time where they're resting in the morning, and all of a sudden late morning, middle of the day, they start popping up. Another thing is really understanding your bucks. So if you're getting pictures of a buck that is in the middle of the night and it's random, I call those non-core bucks. And that buck's coming from somewhere else. He's coming into your property. He might be a mile away, 2 miles away. He comes occasionally because you're part of his loop. But that buck is going to be really hard to kill on the pre-rut even, or even in October. So I'm waiting till the middle of the rut to hunt that buck because he's told me he's going to be back, and he'll be back looking for does after he's found a couple in his area in the pre-rut. He's going to wait till the peak rut. He's going to be over. So I'm not going to hunt that buck until that. In fact, I'm not going to go into that stand location. I'm not even going to go into that location. Even if it's just one quarter of my 40-acre parcel, I want to wait till the optimum conditions to hunt that buck. On the other hand, if I have a core buck I'm getting pictures of over and over again in and around shooting hours in September and early October, I'm not going to wait till the rut to hunt that buck. Because when it gets to the rut, he might be 2 miles away on someone else's land or a mile away. So I'm going in there October 17th, October 20th, October 12th. I'm waiting for those cold front days, and I'm not missing opportunities. So right. Really trying to identify which buck you're after is an important point about maximizing your sits too.
Yeah, and you brought up a great point there. That's one thing that just many people do, especially young people. I mean, kind of like me and Eric.
Oh, yep.
We hunt several small parcels, and then I hunt tons and tons of public land. So it's not like we have unlimited resources, but we've got plenty of stands to go, you know, and hunt on. For the average guy that's got one or two of those small properties, he's wanting to just bang away at that thing all year.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because he's wanting to be in the woods. And basically what you're saying is if you can have a little patience and wait for the exact time frame, perfect time frame, then you can really optimize your sits. And if you check out Jeff's website, you go into even more in depth on this stuff, and he'll explain how to get to that value of 10 out of 10 by using moon, weather, wind, and all that stuff. I mean,
That was I had an article in Outdoor Life last November, and that I talked about the algorithm or the formula. It's not as fancy as an algorithm; it's a formula. But that was in there, and it's really, again, it works really well because most of the neighbors around you are not going to be doing that in any way. They're not going to be practicing it. So the value of you doing that is greatly enhanced when your neighbors are not doing it. And those bucks, especially when they get older, and we're talking 4, 5, 6 year old bucks, that's why I believe that you can be consistently successful on your target buck 80% of the time, just because no one else is using those factors to determine their sit, and that puts a lot of the success right in your lap. And so that's something I follow religiously, and I've been doing that since the early 90s, and it's ingrained in me now. I've learned to be very patient just because of the success, and it's something that works, and I try to teach other people or help them try to figure that out, because it's really fun. Yeah, it's and I get to the point where even when I'm going into a stand, I use a lot of trail cameras, and that's totally another subject, but when I go into a stand, I'll look at a trail camera a lot of times now that's nearby. And if I'm going in, I'm going for a specific buck at a specific time of the day. If I look on that camera and I don't see there's any buck movement that I want on that camera, I'll actually go to another stand. Even though that's what I had planned, that's the one that I had set, it's not that you're wasting time when you're out in the outdoors, but I'm wasting an opportunity on a mature buck because there's probably another stand that might be, you know, have a higher potential because of what's been happening in the previous 7 to 10 days. So that's another part of the sit management. I'll go by current sign, I'll go by rub, scrapes, there's other factors, but that trail cam indication is a big thing too.
Right. And you talk a lot about cold fronts. You weigh a lot of that value scale on cold fronts. And you just mentioned some examples a while ago there. But I also heard you say at one point that really gets magnified if you have like a long period of stagnant weather before a cold front.
Yeah.
You might explain a little bit about what you mean by that.
I look at that the hot weather, the hot, consistent, boring weather is serving to set up that cold front drop. So say, for example, Monday through Friday, you had temperatures of 79, 77, 75, 76, 81. And then all of a sudden on Saturday, you're getting this just nasty weather blowing through. The winds are 40 miles an hour, which also served to set up the drop. And then all of a sudden on Sunday morning, it's supposed to be a low of 27 degrees. It's going to be a high of 51. You just had a 26, 27 degree temperature drop. Your mornings were probably as consistent too. You probably had a 25 degree temperature drop in the mornings too. And those deer were lulled into that heat. They weren't really moving too much. You can imagine those big bucks and their bodies, you know, moving around in that heat. So now all of a sudden you have the front that goes through, and there's a lot of stress and commotion with that front, high winds, noise. They're not really out in their major feeding patterns. So when that finally is cold and it breaks, there's many factors, including the stress and the lack of feeding, the hot weather that was before, and especially if it's 4 or 5 days long, that served to set up the quality of that drop. So that's certainly a factor in determining, if it's going to be a great drop or not.
And the nastier the front, the better, am I correct?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, ideally you'd have thunder and lightning on the front side, maybe an ice storm thrown in and a little snow. So right. That would be, give them a lot of stress. And and one of the things, too, is think about if we're out in the wilderness somewhere, we may say we're out west and we're lost for 4 days, and we had very little water, just enough to survive. We had no food. And when we're finally rescued, we're going to go hit whatever our favorite place is, whatever we can get our hands on some food, and we're going to gorge ourselves. I mean, we're just starving. And the next morning, we might eat a lot for breakfast, too. I mean, we're just trying to replenish. But by the time you get to that second night and the third night, the value of that drop and the value of missing those meals and the value of that stress is just diminished almost completely. And so, when you're even looking at that front, that's why I put so much, I pay so much attention to that first day and maybe the second day too. And by the time you get to the third day, you're almost back to that's just the norm.
Right. And even if the temperatures are lower on that third or fourth day after the front than say they were a week ago, like you said, it's getting back into that stagnant pattern.
Yeah. It's just now 54 degrees is the norm.
Right.
Instead of 72. And it's all relative. I mean, sure, when it gets down, when the daytime highs are in the low 50s, mid-50s in the Midwest, and it's November 5th, 7th, 8th, it's hard to find a terrible day. But if you missed the drop on the front side of that on the 2nd and 3rd of November, you missed a really high-value day. I mean, you might have missed a 10 out of 10, and then you got some 6 out of 10s mixed in there afterwards. But, you really... that first day and that first drop, there's a lot of reason to hunt that.
And you would say hunt these drops any time of the season. Go push into your, go after your best bucks, your best stands, not just during the rut, but any time of the year, even early season, early October.
Oh, definitely. And even in Wisconsin, you were opening in September. There's some outstanding opportunity. The only difference is, in the early season, I'm hunting food source movements. It's hard to beat a buck back to his bedding area, even if you have some quality stands right in his bedding area on the outside that you can come in from a different way. It's hard to beat him back at that time of year, and he's already there. So I'm really not hunting mornings until it gets into the pre-rut. There's some exceptions. I'll hunt areas where it might be a long oak flat, and I'm 200-300 yards off of an ag field, and I'm still 150, 200 yards before a bedding area. I think I can get in there safely because deer might be just browsing through. Buck might step out of his bedding area and get into an area late morning with a full moon. So I'm capitalizing on some of those times, but I'm really placing a priority on evening hunting with cold front drops in the early season and even the late season. And then when it gets into the rut, then I'm looking at hunting morning and evening and staying out in the woods all day.
Sure. And you just brought up another good point that we can segue into this next topic. You deal a lot with staging areas, how to create staging areas, how to hunt staging areas. What's the difference in staging areas? You actually don't you have what's called a bedding area stage and then a feeding area stage? Go ahead and explain that.
Yeah, there's two distinct staging areas, and to me a staging area is, it's that point where a buck gets into and he feels comfortable, and then from that point, he either passes on into a food source, or when he's coming out of his bedding, he's actually heading into towards a food source. So the staging areas on a food source, it's basically that last form of safe cover before they exit and go to a major destination field in the evening. Often, because that's a pretty good cover value, there's tons of rubs, tons of scrapes in that area. And often there's some bedded does. And so really tough spot to hunt, because if you get in there and try to hunt it and you spook out those does, now that staging area might end up being 100 yards back or 200 yards back. You just ruin that, or that last safe zone where they felt they could actually stage up before they went to the food source. And so those staging areas, depending on the location, unless there's a hillside that can get in or a brush obstruction or a ridge, then a lot of times they avoid that. And where I'm hunting primarily is either in between that staging area and the bedding area, or I'm hunting back near the bedding area in an area where I'd like to call a bedding staging area. And that's a really cool spot because what you're doing is this is a spot where a buck exits his bedding area. And once he gets out and he gets into this location, there's going to be a lot of rubs and scrapes. It's one of those areas where you walk in the woods and you think, you know, why are there rubs and scrapes here? Why are there so many right here? And it's because this is a spot where he transitions into before dark. And then from that point, he's slipping up to the staging area, the food source staging area, and actually getting into that food source. So last year, it was the ninth day of Wisconsin's gun, and I was hunting one of those bedding area staging areas, and I shot a real nice buck I was after right about 20 minutes before dark. And he had entered that area. He was heading to a scrape. I actually saw him for about 10 minutes. He'd only moved 30, 40 yards, and he was probably, I would guess, 100 yards away from his bedding area, maybe 150, and he was just into that spot. Well, we were still 350 to 400 yards off the food source. That's where I was getting pictures of him. That's where he was heading, but he probably wouldn't have gotten there till right at dark or a little after dark.
Yeah, that's interesting because we just did a podcast with Dan Imfalt, and he was talking about that a bunch too. Yeah. I mean, he doesn't call
really?
It a bedding staging
cool.
area,
yeah,
but he's always talking about having to get within 150 yards of their bed to kill them in daylight.
Especially on the early sits.
Yeah, and now, you know, you can kind of tie that term to it, or
definitely.
That phrase that you're using, find those stages right next to bedding, and that's going to be where you catch him in daylight. That's pretty interesting.
Oh, definitely. And that's those areas, whether it's morning or evening, mostly morning, but a lot, you know, quite a few evening, those are the areas where I've probably killed at least 80% of my bucks.
Yeah.
And so, and that includes even gun season sets. So those are the areas I love to get into for gun season too. Not necessarily go blow the bedding area out, but, you know, get close enough to where I can get into that. And it's still, there's usually a pretty decent stem count there. So it's fairly thick. Often it's an area where there's overhanging branches, there's cover on the ground, and then it's kind of opening up to safe timber there. They can travel safely to a food source, but it's kind of like, you know, they're leaving the bedding area. This is at the edge of the thick cover, and then they're leaving from there. So that's cool that Dan talked about that, too, because I have a lot of respect for him as a hunter. So it's interesting that he's noted those same things, too.
Yeah. The next thing I want to ask you, we have been talking a ton about bedding areas lately, just in our office and, like, in some of our prior conversations. What really constitutes a good bedding area? I think people have sort of the misconception that they want to create the largest, thickest mass of stuff out there, and that may or may not be exactly what they need to be going for. I think you've got a really good handle on this topic, so I want you to talk about bedding areas, what consists of habitat in a bedding area and how to hunt them. Well, I mean, we've been talking about how to hunt them, but really what is a great bedding area?
Well, to me, you know, there's, of course, doe bedding areas and buck bedding areas, and to me it doesn't really matter how the timber is cut or how it lays or how it grows as far as one type of bedding area for a male versus female. But, you know, even if we just buck bedding areas and why a buck would bed in a location, for one, if you have a major food source and you have quality bedding opportunity adjacent to it, that's where those does will bed. They want to be within 150, 200 yards of their food, and sometimes even closer, and they'll just make that movement every single day. That's just what they'll do. So once you establish where those does are moving from their bedding to the feeding, then the bucks will be on the outside of that movement, and that's the way I see it anyways. So when you get back into those areas, does it kind of make sense that it's almost more important to focus on the doe bedding opportunity than the buck? And the reason I say that is because, you know, if that first bedding opportunity is 300 yards away from the food source, that's where those does are going to bed, and you're not going to have any bucks for, you know, 400 to 500 yards from the food source. On most properties where guys are hunting that are 40 to 100 acres, you're putting those bedding areas on your neighbor's property. So if I was going into work on a bedding area, I'm going to go in and really open up the canopy to get a higher stem count. I'm going to put some logs on the ground so that I have side cover. I'll even use hinge cutting to promote side cover, not necessarily canopies. And canopies are okay in some cases, especially in limited cover areas where you almost need to compartmentalize deer. But I really like bedding areas that allow deer to move around like a maze and pocket effect. They can get in and into it easily, out of it. There's no dead ends. Deer can freely move through it. They're not trapped by any kind of predators. But you're really looking at putting that bedding area. It could be a half acre. It could be an acre. You don't need 10 acres. And so, you know, a doe family group might take over a half acre area, three quarters of an acre. And if you separate those out, to me, you can have more doe family groups. If you put those close to the food, then you're setting up those buck bedding area opportunities behind. And those might be natural lay of the land. It could just be a bench. It could be that you're adding a few cuttings back there. It could be that it's a natural area where the habitat changes a little bit and there's some diversity. But once you have that established, you have food, doe bedding, and then buck bedding opportunity, then typically I'm hunting between the buck and doe bedding area. I'm hunting that transition area in between. Or I'm hunting on the back side of that buck bedding area, and I'm coming in from the opposite direction. So I'm waiting for those deer, you know, from 400 yards in front of me and food to come back to that. And really, it could be just a matter of knocking some timber down and making sure that the deer can move through it, you know, set some trails to get in and out.
Right, and I know...
It's really not too much. It doesn't have to be too fancy, you know, to get the... to actually create a bedding area.
It doesn't have to be real big either.
I've
seen some buck beds that are the size of a little office that sitting in here.
Definitely. It's almost like, that's a cool point, because a lot of times it's almost like you're promoting a pickup bed size bedding area for a buck or bed, and you're knocking down a half acre in timber to protect that area and to make sure that he has enough cover and make sure he has some hardwood regeneration and briars to feed on during the day, which is really important too. They have to, you know, a lot of guys think conifer, and conifer doesn't provide any food during the day at all. So switchgrass, same thing. I love switchgrass. I love conifer, and I love shrubs and hardwood regeneration, where you get it all together as a bedding area. But when it's just pure switch or conifer, they don't want to be there during the day because they're missing a couple feeding opportunities. They just like to stand up and browse and feed on some regeneration. So, but yeah, half acre, if you kind of think in terms of a half acre to an acre, you can really house a lot of deer in that one location.
Right, and I know in southwest Wisconsin you've got a lot of hills and, you know, rolling hills, which is pretty similar to our area of southern Iowa. So how does topography really relate to buck bedding area? How do they use those benches and ridges to locate where they're going to spend their daylight hours?
Well, they're almost 100% of the time going to be on a flat somewhere. And so that flat might be just the upside of a giant oak that's coming out of the side of the hill. They need a flat surface to bed on. But one of the things, if you think back to that alignment of the deer, I've heard the saying like the mature bucks will bed in the top third or the top quarter. But really, if there's a giant ag field up above, those bucks, those does are going to be in the top third and top half of the of the hillside, and the bucks are going to be in the bottom. And then if there's food on the top and the bottom, then the only place really a buck's going to be is in the middle somewhere on a bench. If the food's on the bottom, then those bucks are going to be in the top portion or the middle portion. And so it really depends on the alignment of the food and the does, and really they're going to take over a flat. And so you can look at a lot of hillsides, and I love hills because hills hide deer. They push buck age structure up. They protect bucks, but at the same time, they highly define where deer are going to move. And there might be, you could look at the side of a hill that's 20 acres. There might only be 7 flats on that entire area that, you know, that entire 20 acres that only total an acre. And you know that if they're in a line or if they're in a bench or if they're hidden on a point, you know you can count on deer there. And so if you go in there and just improve it a little bit, just knock down some 7 or 8 trees around that area and clean it up so the deer can move through it. You can highly define where those deer are going to be because of those hills.
Once you do this cutting, creating these beds, how often do you have to go back in and sort of maintain that? I noticed in one of your recent videos you were hinge cutting a bedding area in the winter, and then you were back in there in midsummer trying to clean it out.
Yes, and yeah, in fact, we were just out there last week, and we, you know, so we knocked down the timber, we made a lot of hinge cuts, we tried to clean it up as best as possible, but once that settles, then we were back in there last week, and I just took a handsaw in, and I cleaned it out so that you know, and a good guide is if you or I can walk through it easily without having to bend, stoop, crawl, climb, then it's about right, and so you want those deer to feel like they can move through it very easily. There's no obstructions. You don't want them to have to crawl or jump because they might just avoid the whole bedding area. And of course, you don't want any dead ends. And so you might have a tree that sags down, and that's the kind of the risk you run with some of the hinge cuts. If you're trying to create canopies, is you can have a hinge cut sag, and it can blow out the whole bedding area, meaning that it's right in the middle, and deer just can't even move through that area. And so you don't want any dead ends. You want deer to feel like they can escape in 3-4 different directions. And so typically when you're going back in there, because it makes sense, the more canopies you have, the more maintenance you're going to need, because you really have to pay attention and make sure those aren't falling in. So if those canopies are more, or if those hinges are off to the side more and they're protecting the deer within, you know, by offering side cover and regeneration and browse, then it's a lot more low maintenance. You can go in there once a year, just clean it out with chainsaw or handsaw, and go in there a couple times a year. I look for sheds in those areas. Sometimes I'll put a camera on the outside as deer are going in and out of it, because I want to see what bucks are relating to that. If you're making it correctly and you're not putting too much canopy in there, you really don't have to maintain it more than once or twice a year.
Right, and you make a ton of sense talking about this stuff, because I see a lot of people that want to create these giant, enormous bedding areas, but all these bedding areas that you're creating, you even mentioned in that video, you've got 4 tree stands around that one small bedding area. And that's one thing I think people, they don't understand, is when you create a bedding area in that half-acre size that you're talking about, it's very huntable. You know exactly where those deer are going to be. You know, if you create a giant bedding area where they can scatter all throughout, then it's going to be a lot harder to hunt a specific buck in that spot. Am I correct?
Oh, definitely. It's kind of like on, you know, 40 acres, the worst thing you can do is make 35 acres of bedding. And
sure.
It's because you never know where the deer are going to be, and for that, you can spook them at any turn. Where, you know, one doe family group, a half acre, is all they need. And if that is adjacent to food, they'll use that every single day. And so let's say you cut down 8 to 10 acres of bedding area on a 40-acre parcel. You've effectively made enough room, especially if they're separated out, for 100 deer. And so, you know, how many deer do you have on 40 acres? And so I look at it like, you need a certain amount of cover, transition cover, where you might be taking canopy trees out or completing a select cart timber harvest. But then in those bedding areas, you're creating, you know, good hinge cut, open canopy, full open canopy, a lot of diversity. You might even add conifer to that. And so that, you know, when you walk on that 40 acres, that 90% of the deer that are bedding on there are going to be in those 7 to 10 acres of cuttings that you've created, exactly where you need them to be in relation to your access, your food sources, and how you want the bucks to travel during the day when you're hunting them.
Right, and that kind of goes into, you know, I grew up hunting northern Wisconsin quite a bit, and it was a constant battle of finding deer in big woods settings. So how do you...
Hey, you got gobs and gobs of public land up there.
Oh,
don't
yeah.
You? Just unlimited supply of huge woods.
Lots of it. Yeah.
And the biggest challenge that I always had in that area is eliminating habitat. You know, down here in southern Iowa.
Like a dead zone or
right.
Whatever, where deer wouldn't
use. Yes.
Like I look at, you know, in southern Iowa here, if I'm hunting over a CRP field and I got a plowed field behind me, I can basically eliminate that plowed field. But how do you eliminate areas in those big timber settings where you just have so much to look at?
Yeah, that's in one of the things. That's why I love the aerial photos, and you can even use in some topo maps for that too. But really, you're looking for large masses that are all the same. And so you might have an area that's 10,000 acres, and literally in some of those northern forests, there's 9,000 acres of hardwoods.
Oh, yeah.
And so then you're keying on those areas where there might be some lowland change, maybe even some meadows mixed in, some very steep topography, roads or houses or cabins. So you're trying to X out, for one, the people areas, and then two, you're Xing out everything that's the same, whether it's all a swamp or it's all hardwoods. And then you're just simply keying on the areas that offer the most diversity of change. For example, like you have upper hardwoods that are transitioning into lowland swamp. They have an elevation change. There's a creek that runs through it, and it all empties out into a big beaver pond. You have several habitat changes taking place in one location,
and that creates diversity of cover, diversity of forage, and also it's gonna create edge habitat, and deer are creatures of edge. They're highly creatures of edge. And so where you have 4, 5, 6 different edges coming together in one location, whether it's elevation, habitat, food, water, age of timber could be another thing too.
Yes.
And where you have that all coming together, that's where I key on it. So you can take an aerial photo, and I've done this like up in northern Michigan and the UP of Michigan, and you can really eliminate a lot of acres just by scanning the... And it's not to say there might not be some good hunting areas in those other locations, but you can take 10,000 acres and... You know, the probability that something is really, really good in that 9,500 acres is fairly low. There's going to be some areas. But the probability that there's something really good in the 500 remaining acres is really high. And so you're just playing by percentage and playing the odds and focusing on those habitat changes within that. I love to focus personally. My favorite locations are marshes. For one, marshes and beaver dams. They take out a lot. I used to drive in 2.5 miles back on a 2-track, and it was 5 miles in on a seasonal road, and then it dead-ended at a beaver dam. Once you got to that point, that eliminated a lot of people just driving back there. But two, how many people actually crossed the beaver dam? You know, I fell in a couple times.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
It eliminates a lot of people. Then I'm going one beaver dam further after I went in a quarter mile, and then I'm crossing to some wet marsh where it was halfway up your knee boots, and then I'm getting out to an island system that literally you're out in the middle of nowhere, and I had no competition. There's nobody around there. Now, it took me 45 minutes to get in. You had to use your compass, but I found some outstanding areas. That's going back in the late 90s, early 2000s, where in about a 2-mile stretch, I was able to take some very nice bucks out of there. And I came in from, you know, sometimes I'm parking 3 miles away here and walking in a mile this way, and you know, gave me a lot of playground to enjoy the land, but I was keying on very specific spots that stuck out to me, but I think a lot of people were close to the roads, and of course up there there's a lot of bait hunting, so they're within a couple hundred yards of the road, and I'm in between all of them. So I didn't find a lot of competition, you know, for guys that would do that. I think you weed out a lot of people, but at the same time you can hone in on some really specific locations.
Right, and kind of going off of you mentioned that there is a lot of bait competition, or at least there used to be, you know, in some of those areas. I know now they've, in the county that we used to hunt, they just had a CWD occurrence. So they've banned baiting. And I know you talked about mock scrapes, you know, over water holes and that, but how do you use those mock scrapes to locate bucks during the summer months in an area where you can't use mineral, you can't dump corn? I've heard of a lot of guys, you know, specifically yourself, having some great success locating summer bucks using mock scrapes.
I forget what article it's on my website, but I talk about making mock scrapes. And I have some pictures on there that I believe are from 2005. And what I would do is going into an area and create mock scrapes just by overhanging jack pine branch on a traditional perennial scrape. So it's there every single year. And I'm literally going out there, and I would drink a lot of water, and I'd go in there, I'd start up with a stick, I'd actually pee into the scrape,
yep.
And I'd take a stick, stir it all up, I'd make the scrape, I'd dig it down just so it looked like it was a scrape. You had a fresh earth smell. I even smack the branch a few times so it looked like it's broken up above and gets it fresh and some sap flowing. Mm-hmm. And then I'd put a camera on it and leave. And I have pictures of, even at that time, bucks coming in, and I think it was August 5th, August 6th.
Wow.
And you can kind of take inventory of the bucks by doing that. And then if you combine that with old sign, and that's what I hunt a lot, is I hunt a lot more old sign than fresh sign, because out in those swamps, you don't have big food sources and huge social areas where deer are just pounding it with lots of sign. I mean, you might have a giant buck that chews in the area, but he's only laying down one massive rub every 200 yards. And so it's not like these big clusters. You're looking for just pieces. And so it really, those pieces aren't popping up till right during the rut. And so if you're waiting till that time, you might be really set up for a great spot, and then there's no sign. And so I like hunting old sign, which is way more important than fresh sign. Looking for the history of rubs, and out in the swamps, you're looking out at carved out jack pine where you can see it from 100 yards away that it's been bowed out by rubs for many years. I love those things. I mean, it's kind of like you see those. I don't even care if there's a fresh rub on it. If it if it matches up with the funnels that you're looking at, and it matches up with the lay of the land, I mean, it could be a money stand. And then it's just a matter of, yeah, you can hunt these two trees. You go in there. If you have seven or eight areas like that, you just go in and look for the fresh signs, sit down, and wait for them to come by. Mm-hmm.
That's what, I mean, we talk about that all the time. Postseason scouting is just like one of the most important things you can do, especially when you're trying to intricately learn a piece of property. You got to go in right after the season before everything gets on.
Right.
Or like Dan even mentioned last week, he said, if you kill your buck and you don't have anybody else going in there, he's like, then scout the rest of the season on that property. That way you can see that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and that's the thing, too. What's kind of cool with that was a lot of those big woods bucks, they're moving through those areas because of the lay of the land. They're avoiding hunting pressure that sometimes is a half mile, mile away. There's very specific spots that they're crossing creeks on and going across the hillsides if there's any, avoiding beaver dams and marsh areas. So what happens when you kill a buck out of one of those areas, very likely within the next 2 to 3 years, there's going to be another one that takes its place. Not necessarily the next year, because you almost have to wait for one to get kind of locked in and slotted into that area. But and it's the same on private land, too. But on out in the public land, it can really help you. By, you know, I have a spot where I killed a really nice buck in 2011. Consider him a five-year-old eight-point. It was a beautiful buck and just a needle in a haystack up in Michigan. And I've been back there since, and one of the times is a two-year-old buck that came by and a yearling buck. But it's one of those where I can go out and I know there's going to be bucks that move through that area. And if there's a big one in there, it's just a matter of looking at the sign, and then you really know how to hunt them. You already killed the one, and you already had the setups for it, and so it's kind of cool if you can develop that over the years, because another buck will historically take over that area.
Okay, that brings up a great point and a great segue into our viewer question for you. That Bobby Reese asked us on Facebook last week how to determine hot versus cold sign. And we're obviously talking about reading old sign and stuff, but what if you're going in to a brand new area, like a lot of people do, especially non-residents down in our area? They'll come in with the tree stand and sticks on their back, and they'll just go walking into a 5,000-acre piece and try to figure out where to hunt. How do you determine which sign is hot, which sign to hunt, and which sign is not as fresh, you know, and that you need to ignore?
You know, it's, I guess one of the big things that's, you know, of course, I love big tracks. I love big, clean tracks. I'm not talking about dew claws digging and down in the ground, but I'm talking if I take my index finger, middle finger, and ring finger, if I can set it in the inside of a clean track, then that's a big track. You know, it's a big, just a nice print. So that's one thing. I love looking for big tracks. But one of the things that I think a lot of people get really hung up on are rubs. And I love rubs, and I love fresh rubs. But it's very deceiving. You go into, say, a white oak flat that was really hot in September, late September, and I can think of a particular one in southwest Ohio, or southeast Ohio, out in the public land, and it's just full of rubs and full of scrapes. And you look at those rubs, and if you're in there in the middle of November, end of November, and you're there during the rut or peak rut, you're going to find that the shreds from those rubs and the shavings from those rubs are all under the leaves. And so that's really critical. You look at all these rubs, and it's hard to tell sometimes. Was it last week, 2 weeks ago? But you're going to find a lot of those, they were made before the leaves dropped. And so that's a really good indication from rubs. Are those shavings on top of the leaves or under? And it might seem, you know, kind of basic, but I think sometimes those rubs, there's such a lure with them that they're just hard to pull yourself away when you have this giant rub and you know that something big made it. And so fresh tracks, fresh rubs, or the shavings are on top of the leaves. And then at the same time, you're trying to put it all together. You're not just looking for sign. You're looking for sign in areas that make sense for why the sign's there in the first place. So, again, you're going back to those maps, and you're looking at this funnel right here, this saddle right here, this area between these two points, or this flat in the bottom, or this bent should have sign because of this. You know, they're feeding on greenbrier up on the tops, and there's a lot of cuttings up there, and there's fresh pellets. There's a lot of fresh scrapes down below. You can see they're being made every day. But you're looking in those areas where there should be sign, and then you're looking for fresh pellets, shavings on top of the leaves, and big fresh tracks to let you know that it's there. And if it's not there, then just move. Because really, if you're hunting a big area and you know some big ones there, you're going to find it eventually. You're going to find the active sign eventually.
Sure. Well, this has been some pretty great stuff, Jeff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're coming up on an hour here, and I know that you're a super busy man. So I'll.
This has been fun. I, as you can tell, I love talking about this stuff.
So. Oh, yeah, so do we. I mean, Bill's probably mad at us because we're not getting more work done, but this is what we really love doing is talking about deer hunting. So.
Yeah, that's great to talk to you guys. And, like I said, any other time you want to talk, you're welcome to. I love, this is what we all live, so we're lucky to be in this industry and do what we do, and very blessed to do that. So I appreciate it, guys. I really do.
Yep. Thanks for coming on, Jeff. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. We'll talk to you later.
Yep, see ya.
Yeah, bye.
Well, that was pretty cool, huh?
Oh, yeah. Lots of good stuff there.
He's got tons of information, and he is one of the foremost experts, I believe, on that habitat stuff as far as managing your property to really get the most out of your property. And he's an expert when it comes to large farms and small farms alike,
public and private.
Yeah, exactly. And like we've touched on lots of topics that he's pretty familiar with in this podcast, but if you want to learn more, like we said at the beginning, go over to the Whitetail Habitat Solutions webpage and check out some of his stuff. Jeff's got books, he's got articles, everything that you would need as a land manager and a whitetail hunter. So check out Jeff Sturgis. He knows his stuff, and man, that was a very refreshing podcast.
Definitely.
With him.
Definitely. Yep. Lots of stuff there that anybody can do.
Yeah, right. That's what we love about it all is, like, I mean, we can take the info learned there and just
head. Go apply it. Right.
We can go right out there and do it. I mean, I've been thinking about water holes for weeks now.
Yep.
So he shed a lot of light on that, but, that's going to wrap it up for this week's Whitetail Watch podcast. We appreciate y'all joining us, and we look forward to catching you on in the next one.